No child is born racist. That's what Nelson Mandela believed. And he could have added, no child is born sexist or a bully either. Raising a child who isn't any of those things doesn't just happen, though. When science journalist and mum Melinda Wenamoya went looking for research into the best ways to ensure that children don't end up as jerks, she was surprised about how different professional guidance is from deeply held parenting instincts. So she wrote a book about it. It's called, well, I'm going to call it How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Jerks. If you're looking for it on Google, there's a certain eight-letter A word that you might want to sub in for jerks. Melinda joins me now. Hi there.
Hi, Jesse. Thanks for having me.
Nice to chat to you today. Did you start this project looking at some adults and thinking, wow, I don't want my kid ending up like that?
Yeah. Yes, actually, that is exactly what happened. Well, as you can probably tell, I'm from the U.S. And a couple of years ago, I was getting frustrated by all the bad behavior I was seeing around me from people in positions of political power here, and also from the Me Too allegations that were hitting the news. And yeah, I honestly looked at all the bad behavior and I thought, how do I make sure that my kids do not grow up to be jerks like that? And I talked to other parents and they said, yeah, we're actually really thinking about this a lot more than we expected as well. And so that was really the impetus for the book.
Are kids today less kind than they used to be?
Well, there is some evidence that in recent years, anyway, rates of bullying have been going up and also hate crimes have been increasing. And there's also some sort of more longitudinal research that suggests that kids, especially college age kids now compared to in generations past, they have less empathy. They are less able to put themselves in other people's shoes or maybe less willing to put themselves in other people's shoes. And so, yeah, there is some evidence of it. And again, it could be because kids are kind of learning from some bad examples that are around them. It's kind of hard to tell exactly what's happening, but
yeah. Could we call it a kindness crisis?
That would be, I think, a very appropriate way to describe it.
Do we need to tread carefully having this conversation when a big parenting trend at the moment is praising kids, building up their self-esteem, making them feel good about themselves rather than talking about faults?
Yes, yes, that is something that I know, you know, I think parents are very well-meaning in wanting to make their kids feel, you know, as good about themselves as they can. And one of the ways we do this is through effusive praise and sometimes what's called inflated praise. This is a term that researchers actually use. And it means, you know, let's say your child draws a very simple stick figure drawing and shows it to you. And then you say, oh, that's the most beautiful drawing I've ever seen. You know, you're really, really over the top. That's called inflated praise. And the research actually suggests that when we kind of overpraise our kids, we actually, especially if they start out with low self-esteem anyway, we actually cause their self-esteem to drop even more. And that's kind of surprising. It's the opposite of what we want. But that, as well as kind of trying to protect our kids from failure and from challenges, which is, again, a well-meaning parenting approach, that too can give them a hit to their self-esteem, because really, it's when kids can experience challenges and get through them and realize, you know, oh, actually I learned from that and I survived that. That's what gives them a good sense of self-worth and self-esteem.
Does it take more intention to raise a child that isn't rude or entitled, particularly in the modern era?
You know, I think so, in part because I think a lot of our parenting instincts, when I looked at the research, so I'm a science journalist, and so everything that I write about, I root in science. And when I looked at the research on what kinds of parenting approaches actually do shape the development of traits like generosity and kindness and healthy self-esteem, a lot of the instincts we have, a lot of the things that we do as parents that are sort of come naturally to us, those aren't always the most constructive ways to go about helping our kids. And so because of that, I do think, you know, especially once you're familiar with what the research says, and that's essentially what's in my book, you know, you have to sort of take a minute sometimes to think about the best ways to respond to your child in a moment, because sometimes, yeah, our instincts aren't exactly right. And also, I think parenting is very emotional. It's very reactive. You know, our kids do something And we sometimes react in a way that isn't always the most constructive. And that's just because, you know, parenting is hard. We're tired and we can't always be rational in the way we interact with our kids. But I do think, you know, the more we are aware of what's actually helpful, and the more we sort of take a minute, take a breath before we respond to our kids, the more we can help them become, you know, more kind and generous and thoughtful people.
You say that sometimes kids are supposed to act in ways that mortify their parents. Why should we learn to see that as a good thing?
Yes, right. So first of all, kids' brains are very different from adult brains. And the part of their brain, the prefrontal cortex, that is responsible for rational behavior, for impulse control, all the things that we kind of think of as being, you know, quote unquote, good behavior, that part of the brain does not fully develop until kids are 25. So it takes a really long time for kids to really develop, you know, that ability to think rationally and be thoughtful and make plans and follow through on plans and hold back their impulses. So they're really just, you know, they're not able to act in the way we sometimes hope and expect that they do. And also, you know, if you think about the kinds of things we expect from people in terms of good and polite behavior, a lot of those are learned, you know, they're cultural norms. They are not things that kids are born knowing. I mean, if you think about even just holding a fork and eating food with a fork, that's not something that comes naturally to anybody. I have a 7-year-old and she struggles a lot with using a fork. And so, yeah, a lot of the things that we expect, these are learned, they take time to learn. And, you know, so kids in a way are kind of supposed to make mistakes sometimes. That's how they learn. They need to push our buttons. They need to cross the boundaries that we set so that we know how, you know, we know that it's something that we need to talk about. I think of misbehavior as a kind of opportunity for us as parents to realize what skills our kids need to be working on and what kinds of conversations we need to be having with them.
What are some traits that we might find in a kid who may be on the road to being a not very nice person?
Well, I did break down my book into a number of traits and tried to kind of describe what the science says on the opposite of that. So one big one is, you know, selfishness. You know, when kids or adults are really selfish, they're thinking only about themselves. That's something that I consider, you know, not something we really want in our kids. Same with kind of a lack of resilience or even like a sort of laziness, like a desire to not put out any effort in anything that we do. That's another kind of trait that I think we all want our kids to avoid. Bullying, of course, which you already mentioned. You know, we don't want our kids to be bullies. And then I also really dug into how sexism develops and how racism develops in order to understand what we can be doing as parents to, you know, really foster the opposite of those in our kids. Those were some of the big ones that I focused on.
And by the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm talking to Melinda Winnemoyer. Her book is called How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Jerks. And in the book, you reference a piece by a science writer, Joshua A. Krish, who raises the question of whether kindness can backfire. If we raise our kids to be generous, are we raising them to be taken advantage of? What do you make of that thesis?
Right. I think this is something I hear a lot, that, well, if we raise our kids to be kind and compassionate, isn't this in a way going to hold them back? Aren't they going to get walked all over by their peers, by other people? And doesn't this mean they won't succeed ultimately? Because don't you kind of have to be really tough and aggressive in order to succeed? And I disagree with this, and I think the science also does. I mean, for one thing, I think we can teach our kids to be generous and compassionate, but we can also teach them to stand up for themselves and to be assertive and confident. And so these two kinds of traits can coexist. One does not have to exist at the expense of the other. And also, there's really convincing research that suggests that that kids who are kind, those are actually the kids who become more successful in the long run. There was a really interesting study of kindergarten boys that was published, where researchers observed kindergarten boys in the classroom and saw how generous and helpful and kind they were to their peers. And then they tracked them for another 20 years and found that the kids who were kindest in kindergarten, those kids were the most successful when they were 25. They were earning more money. They were less likely to be in prison. And so there's books written about this. Adam Grant, he's a psychologist here in the US. He wrote a book called Give and Take, which is essentially all about the idea that kindness is often what separates the most successful from the least successful, that being generous and kind can really reap these rewards.
As a parent, academic scores, results are much more tangible, aren't they? Is that one reason we tend to focus on those things rather than what you might call the softer skills?
Right. Yes, I think so. And I think we're all worried about our kids succeeding. We do think, as you say, it's tangible. This report card in front of us it represents so much in terms of what we think about the potential for our kids to succeed. And so, yes, we focus on that. And actually, what's really interesting too, in some of my research on self-esteem, I was surprised to find that when we put a lot of pressure on our kids to do well in school, when we talk a lot about grades, when we pressure them to get the lead in the school play or something, or to make a sports team, that kind of pressure also is really kind of detrimental to kids and their self-esteem. It was one of the more interesting and counterintuitive things I found in the research, that this kind of well-meaning pressure we put on kids to do well in school can ultimately, really have them question their self-worth, because they start to think that our love for them is contingent on what they do and how well they do in school, for instance. And they sort of, we don't say this, but they perceive that. And when they perceive that our love is contingent on what they do, that really gives them a hit to their self-esteem.
So, Melinda, what can we do to tame the selfish streak in our children?
Well, one of the really big things I uncovered in the research, and it's a little bit counterintuitive, is that allowing our kids to have big feelings and validating and acknowledging those feelings is actually a really powerful way to help them learn how to become generous and compassionate. And this might seem a little strange, but if you think about it, if you think about what it takes for someone to be generous or helpful to someone else, they have to be able to perceive another person's feelings and perceive another person's needs in a particular moment and say, oh, my friend looks sad, and therefore I should come over and ask him if he needs a hug. And in order to get fluent in that way with emotions and to be able to read other people's emotions, it can be very helpful for parents to just, allow their kids to have emotions, talk about emotions, talk about your own emotions as a parent. And this really lays the groundwork for a skill called theory of mind, which is ultimately, the ability to take someone else's perspective, to understand what someone else needs. And there's actually really interesting research that shows this. I don't know if I could, there's a really interesting study that I could describe if we have time.
Yes, please.
Okay, I'll try to be quick though. So researchers invited moms and preschool kids into the lab and asked the moms to read a book to their kids, and then observed how many times the moms sort of paused to talk about feelings, like the characters' feelings in the books. And they after that, they individually took each child into another room where there was a researcher, and the researcher played with the kid and then pretended to need help with something. So she would drop a pencil and say, oh, I dropped my pencil. I can't pick it up. I wish I could reach it. Or she would say, I'm so cold. I wish I had that blanket over there across the room. And they would see, if the child would help the researcher who said they needed help. And they found that the kids whose moms talked about feelings in the first part of the experiment, and the assumption was that those moms talked about feelings a lot at home, those kids were the ones who were most likely to help the researchers in the second part of the experiment. So it's a really interesting illustration of the strength of this link here between talking about feelings and being compassionate and helpful and generous.
Can I ask you how to deal with a couple of specific things? First is when a child hits their sibling. I mean, that's tends to happen in families, right?
Yes, certainly in my family sometimes. Usually hitting happens because there's some underlying big feeling, often anger or frustration. So if a child hits a sibling, I think the first thing is for a parent to acknowledge those feelings and say, oh my gosh, you look very angry, you look upset, and allow them to have that anger and that feeling. But then you can respond to how they handled that feeling and say, but we cannot hit other people. So, you're allowing them, you're saying, it's not bad that you're angry, but you did make a mistake in hitting. Hitting is not an appropriate way to handle that anger. And so what you try to do, and sometimes it's best to wait until your child has calmed down a little bit because then they're better able to listen, is then you might, you know, talk about why it's not okay to hit, that it hurts other people, that it's dangerous, and try to maybe brainstorm some other ways they can handle their anger. Is there another way that you could let out this anger in the moment? That's just for that particular situation that could be helpful. But generally speaking, when kids are fighting, it's really helpful as a parent to sort of mediate the conflict and help them talk about how they feel and why they're upset, and then help them brainstorm a solution that will kind of be like a compromise.
What about meltdowns? What's the right response from a parent in that situation?
Well, meltdowns are, oh goodness, I feel like we have a lot of meltdowns in my house. And they are so hard. They're so hard for parents because sometimes it just seems like kids have a meltdown over the tiniest little thing, right? And you wonder, why are you so upset about this teensy thing? Like, you know, you give them the wrong kind of cracker and they're crying for 5 minutes on the floor wailing.
It was the wrong color cup in my house yesterday.
Okay, yes, exactly, right. So they're very hard for parents because we don't understand what our kids are going through. And it seems as though that's such an overreaction. But really, for the kid, for whatever reason, it was really a big deal. And it legitimately was. And so I think, even though it's difficult, the best thing to do is to just let our kids have those feelings, not shame them for it, not tell them to stop. Don't say, that's not a big deal. Why are you freaking out? Even though that's maybe what we think. But if they're really being overly, you know, if they're screaming so loud it hurts your ears, or if they're doing something that's not acceptable, throwing things, that's when you can say, you know, you're upset. I understand you're so mad, but if you need to be screaming that loudly, can you please go outside, or can you please go to your room? Or I know you're so upset, but you cannot throw that book. You know, why don't you stomp your feet, or you know, I don't know, bang the ground or something. But so you want to let them still have those feelings, tell them the feelings are okay, but then address whatever behavior that they might be doing that's not acceptable.
Meltdowns and hitting and bad behavior. That's the bread and butter of parenting advice. But you actually go further in your book, and you take on a pretty tough topic, which is racism. And presumably that's a reflection of what the world is going through at the moment, and it's one of the, I guess, the big issues in people's minds. What is the right way to approach race, if at all, when raising your child? I think it's your view that that it's an illusion to think we can just raise them to be colorblind by never bringing it up.
Right. Yes. After looking at the research on this, I was very convinced, and honestly, at first, a little surprised by how strongly the research suggests that we really can't just ignore race and expect that our kids will grow up and not see skin color or not think it's a big deal. What the research shows is that kids, from the time they're babies, really, they do notice skin color. And kids are like little detectives. They are looking around the world and trying to understand it, trying to understand why it looks the way it does, and trying to understand which social categories matter. And so when kids notice race, they also notice that there is a very salient racial hierarchy in society. And they will see, I mean, here in the US, we've had one president who has not been white. And we have, you know, politicians are mostly white. And in general, people in positions of power and high status are white. And when kids see that, and they also, of course, notice these skin color differences, they will, if they're not given information by their parents or by teachers about why these hierarchies exist, and if they aren't told, well, you know, racism is responsible for a lot of this hierarchy, then kids will come to the sort of simplest conclusion, which is, I guess white people are just better or smarter or more powerful. And so this is what the research shows happens if parents don't talk about race. It's really hard sometimes to talk about race if you're white, and especially if you were raised in a family that didn't talk about it. It feels like a taboo subject. But the problem is when kids aren't, you know, when we don't take the time to talk about it, and when we just gloss over it, kids then start to worry that, you know, color is bad, that race is bad, that, you know, being non-white is bad. And so these are the things that we need to address with our kids so that we interrupt the development of that prejudice.
Yeah, you haven't shied away from the stuff in the book. And it also talks about how to talk around sexism and gender and also sex and consent. We don't have time for that today, but I do want to point out, Melinda, that as parents, we are only human, and sometimes we'll have maybe not a meltdown, but perhaps act a bit like jerks ourselves in front of our kids. What's the right thing to do when you realize that you may have raised your voice unnecessarily or got cross when you shouldn't have?
Right. Yes. I mean, I have to say, I have read all of this research and written this book, and I still, you know, lose it with my kids sometimes. Nobody is perfect. What I try to do in those moments after I get angry is I try to help myself calm down. And then I go back to my kids and I apologize. I take responsibility for what I did. I will say, I'm so sorry that I just got so mad at you. You know, I don't really have an excuse, but I'm tired and I just didn't handle it well. And sometimes it even helps to then kind of brainstorm with them and say, well, what do you think I could have done in that moment to help myself control my anger so that I didn't yell at you? What could I do next time? And kids love to have these conversations and give you advice. It's great. And so my kids will say things like, well, next time, mommy, I think you should take some deep breaths before you start talking. And, or maybe you should sit down and meditate, or, you know, they'll say the greatest things. But I think, you know, it's important for us as parents to convey to our kids that we are all human and we're all works in progress. We all make mistakes, and mistakes are okay. They're just part of being human. And I think when we do that, that helps our kids, you know, understand that when they make mistakes, it's okay. And they, as long as they try to learn from them and grow from them, you know, mistakes are just like part of life. They're part of learning. So that's generally what I do. And yeah, because none of us are perfect.
Hey, well done on this book. Thank you so much for chatting to us about it. I've been talking to science journalist and mom, Melinda Wenamoya, and her book is called How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Jerks. If that's not working in your Google results, well, you can find a link on our page, that word jerks. It's actually a word that we don't usually say on the radio. You can find it if you're interested. I'm sure it won't be hard. Melinda, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Jesse.